We should get started. We have a lot of material to cover. I'm Daryl Moore, District 2's council member here, and I appreciate each and every one of you coming out. It's great to see everyone. We have Councilmember Max Anderson from District 3 here as well, as along with a lot of staff. And we'll get to those introductions as we proceed through this evening. But I do want to recognize our planning director, Dan Marks, who's here as well. And with that, as most of you know, several years ago, the citizens of Berkeley overwhelmingly voted for Measure G. It won by some 81% of the vote in Berkeley, which calls for us reducing our greenhouse gas emissions in the city by the year 2050, I believe by 80%. 80%, that's a huge goal if we can reach that, accomplishment I should say. But if we're gonna do that, it's gonna take an action plan. So under the direction of the mayor and our planning department, we are looking at a draft climate action plan to help us achieve that 80% reduction by the year 2050. And so we're going around to various communities, at least the city is, going around to various communities and talking about the plan, getting your suggestions, your ideas. And that's important. You know, we want to hear from you, to see your thoughts, hear your concerns, and just talk these things through, because it's going to take each and every one of us doing our part if we're going to achieve this 80% reduction. And I don't need to go into the fact that it's an issue. You can look around us. The solar caps are melting and go on and on. So it's an important issue. Again, I want to thank you all for being here. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Timothy Burrows of the Planning Department, who will introduce the rest of the staff who will be making presentations later. Also, let me just also introduce, for District 2, our Energy Commissioner, Tim Hansen, who's also here tonight as well. So thank you all for coming. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. I'm Timothy Burrows. I'm the Climate Action Coordinator for the City of Berkeley. I work in the Office of Energy and Sustainable Development, which is housed in the Planning Department. And I wanted to first just thank Councilmember Moore and Councilmember Anderson for being kind enough to host the meeting here tonight. As Councilmember Moore mentioned, 81% of us voted for an aggressive emissions reduction target globally, and voted to sort of direct the city to develop a plan for achieving that target. So it's clear that a large majority of us in Berkeley agree that we need to do something locally in our community about this issue, about this global issue. But just because we agree that we have to do something doesn't mean we agree on what that something is. And so we developed a climate action plan that really was born out of a community process. We've had several meetings like this. We've been to several commissions. We've had a number of town hall meetings. We've been to council a number of times. We've visited a number of different local organizations and gotten on their agendas. And the draft climate action plan that's out right now is really the product of a lot of meetings like this, a lot of feedback that we've gotten from you, from residents and business people in the community. There is a draft that's currently out for public comment. It's open for public comment until January 16th. Any comments you make here tonight will certainly be recorded by us and taken back, and we'll do our best to integrate them into the plan. There's also a website that I'll post later, berkeleyclimateaction.org, which is a great place to read the plan and sign up and provide comment. There's executive summaries here, and I have a few full copies of the plan here, just a couple that you're welcome to take if we run out, which we will. You can email me, and I'll send you a full copy. I'd be happy to do that. So tonight is another opportunity to learn about the issue of climate change, get an overview of what's in the climate action plan now, and provide feedback on the climate action plan. Now, having done many of these meetings, I know that we have many different opinions in our community, and a lot of us are very passionate about our opinions, and that's one of the things that makes Berkeley great. So all I would request respectfully is that we respect each other's opinion. And even if you disagree with your neighbor, that's okay. The point of tonight is to get all of the opinions out and for us to record them and take them back and do our best to integrate them into the climate action plan. One thing is absolutely clear, and one of the reasons I love my job is because what we do here in Berkeley matters. It's true that if Berkeley reduced its greenhouse gas emissions to zero, it probably wouldn't affect the climate crisis all that much. But what happens in Berkeley is often copied by other cities across the state and across the country. And what happens at the community level, at the city level, affects state policy, which affects a much broader swath of the population. So it matters what we do here, and it matters what our climate action plan looks like. And so we look forward to your feedback. I'm going to pass around a sign-up sheet. You've seen a couple sign-up sheets tonight. This one is if you're interested in keeping track of the climate action planning process, staying up to date on events like this. You can put your email here, and we'll include you on the list, and we'll send you an email periodically to keep you up to speed. You don't have to sign up if you don't want to. So, and a little bit later, I'm going to give an overview of the climate action plan. But first, I'm going to turn it over to Bruce Reardon, who's going to talk a little bit about the urgency of the issue, the impacts, and the science of climate change, very briefly. Bruce is born and raised in Berkeley. He is a consultant for the four regional agencies, the Association of Bay Area Governments, the Air Quality Management District, the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, and the Bay Conservation and Development Commission. And Bruce actually worked directly with Vice President Al Gore on his Inconvenient Truth slideshow. He's going to show us a few slides that are sort of derived from that tonight. So I'm going to turn it over to Bruce now. Thanks,
Timothy. So I have five slides, that's all, since we're here tonight really to talk about the Berkeley's plan and to talk about and get your input on it. But Timothy asked me to do just a few minutes, and so I'll take five slides, five words on each one, just to set the context. Why do we care? Why should we have a climate plan? And the first slide and the first word is really now. You know, we talk a lot about things that are going to happen with global warming in the middle of this century and in the end of this century, but the truth of it is we have a lot of serious impacts from climate change going on right now on all continents. This slide that I picked here, just the significant and very serious changes, about a 30% reduction already in the Arctic sea ice just in the last 25 years or so. We will probably be ice-free in the summer in the Arctic probably within 10 years. And that process is accelerating. If I had been here a year ago, I would have told you it was 25 years. So the whole thing is moving rather quickly here. So we're seeing more extreme rainfall events because warmer air can hold more water. So when you get rain and snow events, you get heavier downpours, which causes much more problems for our infrastructure and all. You're seeing sea level rise. We've already seen 8 inches of sea level rise in the last 100 years out here at the Golden Gate. Oldest tidal gauge and sea level rise measurement on the West Coast. So we've seen 8 inches. We're going to get a lot more than that, but we're seeing impacts right now. Heat waves, a whole set of things across the world. The second word is choices, and this is about our future. This is important, that we don't just have one warming world, that we're not just going from today to a warmer world. There are some different scenarios that could play out, and we and our brothers and sisters around the world will have a lot to do with which of these scenarios we pick. So this is a State of California slide from a terrific piece they did called Our Changing Climate. And they picked three different scenarios for a lower warming, a medium warming, a higher warming. And these are showing the extreme heat days in these various cities. An extreme heat day is defined as the 40 hottest days of the year. So just think of wherever you are, it's a different temperature, but it's the hottest days of the year. And instead of having 40, let's pick San Francisco, in the lower warming scenario, you'd add another 40 of those hot days. You'd have 80 of those hottest days a year. If you went to the medium scenario in San Francisco, you're talking about adding 80 days, and in the red scenario, really kind of off the charts. So you're talking a kind of a catastrophic change, a very serious change, and a significant change. But the choice really here is ours. What we do with other countries around the world will determine whether we get onto a lower or a medium or a warming trajectory here, and we'll get these kinds of results. I could show you a whole bunch of these slides where they could look at snowpack with the same thing. Will we end up with 50% of our snowpack, or will we end up with 20% or 10%? It's really a lot up to which scenario we and the other countries of the world end up on. The third word is urgency. We can't wait until this slaps us in the face, which is what we do mostly with problems, particularly with environmental problems. There is without going into all the science, there's a lag in the system. And there's about a 30-year lag. And so we've got about another degree of warming already in the pipeline. If we stopped every emission of greenhouse gases today, which we aren't, but if we stopped them all, there's about another degree that would take about another 30 years to get to us. So there's a lag in the system. And it's very important. We're on this blue line now, headed towards here. This is kind of the business as usual for global greenhouse gas emissions per year. So we're on a line that's increasing that number by about 2 or 3% a year. We've got to move from this kind of trajectory to one of these. These are safer paths towards a better future. It's not going to be a great future, but it's certainly a better future, much better than this. Now, you'll notice here, in these kind of safer theoretical paths that have been built, they level off worldwide in terms of emissions in the next 10, 12, maybe 15 years and start down at a gradual level. That's the safest and best route to take. But we're nowhere close to leveling off. Like I said, we're going up 2 or 3% a year. So this is going to take more than little marginal changes. We're going to have some significant shifts. If you wait, and we probably will, unfortunately, if we wait, that is a much tougher drop to make. If you wait and go further up this line, that's a much steeper drop. That's more costly, and in some ways in the physical world, impossible. You could set in motion here things like melting of Greenland and other things that are starting to see more evidence of, and you can't reverse it after you've gone a certain ways up the line. So there's a real sense of urgency here. We need long-term solutions, but we've also got to start looking more at some things we can do in the next 10, 12, 15 years. Not a pretty picture. Here's the fourth word in the fourth slide. This is now the law in California. California, first state in the union now to pass a law that says by 2020, we are going to cap our emissions in California from all sources at the same level they were in 1990. This is a political goal. It has no science to it. It's just something the state said, get us something we think we can accomplish. It's a stretch, but something we think we can do. So we're headed in the state we're right here about now, in our state, in terms of all emissions. We're supposed to be here in 2020, but the law says we got to cut that by about 30% from the projected business as usual back to the 1990 level. And there's a whole plan out now, and Timothy can talk a little bit about how Berkeley's plan can fit with that plan for the state. But that's a pretty good drop, but it's doable. Here is the real eye on the prize here. This is not a political goal. This is more of a science goal here. And the state doesn't have this as a law yet. The state has this as a governor's executive order. And it says by 2050, we have to cut our emissions by 80% below 1990. So that is perfectly in line with the Berkeley plan and the Berkeley goal. So this is going from 14 tons per person a year to 10 to 1.5. I mean, we can do this. This is going to be doable. This is going to be a tremendous shift in our economy, in the way we live, the way we drive. I mean, this is all about transportation and buildings and electricity generation. Those are kind of our big three, and you'll see them in the plan tonight as we go through it. But this is the law now, and this is going to give us a certain amount of push that we can start working with the California state law on our side. So last slide. Those other slides are pretty discouraging in many ways. It's a huge problem. It's a worldwide problem. It's going to be a tremendous effort here. But I'll give you some hope to finish my slides with. We have in the Bay Area, and this is going on around the country, some tremendous examples of projects that people are taking on now. Not because there's a regulation or because there's a law, because they jumped in and saw a problem and saw a way that they could take a part of that and do something with it. In some cases, they're saving money by doing it, but that's good. So we're seeing big businesses like Adobe. We're seeing transit agencies like Caltrain. We're seeing this is Schaefer Winery in Napa. This is the Fruitvale Transit Village. You know, we're seeing a whole set of things that are being done by government, by businesses, by schools, by NGOs. It's a tremendous. I have a database now of about 200 of these projects, and they're really inspiring. It's my favorite work.
What are they doing?
They're doing a whole set of things. These guys did a 40% cut in their energy budget for the entire set of buildings and made all their money back that they invested in 4 years. This is Adobe headquarters in San Jose. These guys were the first winery to go fully solar for all of their operation, all of their electricity here. Caltrain here, you know, the idea that faster transit is actually attractive to people. Caltrain cut with a baby bullet about 30 minutes off the San Francisco to San Jose run, really sped up the run by doing express trains, and ridership jumped 30%. Fruitvale Transit Village, great example of again, we're starting to plan better. We're starting to plan transit and land use together. You can't plan transportation and land use separately. They have to be planned together. This is a company in Silicon Valley that gave $5,000 to each of their employees that bought a hybrid. The CEO just got this, you know, the fever about something, you know. So people are jumping in. Apollo Challenge is doing, Van Jones doing a whole set of things on green jobs. What can we do with green jobs? What can we do to make sure that this whole move with climate includes everyone? And doesn't just solve, and this is very important, that we don't just frame this as solving the climate problem. We're improving the Bay Area. We're improving the world that we live in, and we're going to get climate change reductions out of that. So a whole set of things, wonderful things. And if I have a website, bayareaclimate.org. If you look at bayareaclimate.org, you can see our database. We'll have a better version of it in a few weeks, but for now it's decent. You can see the projects. So that's my set of five slides, and I'll turn it back to Timothy. And thanks for your attention.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So what I'd like to do now is I'd like to give you, walk you through the draft Berkeley Climate Action Plan. I'll talk a little bit about where our emissions come from and what are some solutions here locally that we can implement to reduce those emissions to achieve our goals. First thing I want to look at is where our emissions come from in Berkeley. This pie chart is basically a snapshot of Berkeley's emissions for the year 2005. And this is an important tool for us, and it's an important tool for cities all over the country because it helps communities understand the main sources of our emissions. And when you understand that, you can come up with better solutions for addressing those emissions. This inventory was conducted by an organization called ICLEI, which is the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives. They provide sort of the state-of-the-art inventory methodology for communities across the country and across the world. And this does have some limitations, but it also has a lot of value. One of the values is that if you take an inventory every year or every other year, regularly, basically, you can establish a trend for what your community's emissions are doing over time. So this is 2005. We can do another one for 06, 07, 08, and see whether our emissions are going up or are they going down. Another cool thing about the inventory is, like I said, it shows the main sources of greenhouse gas emissions. So transportation, for example, is about 47% of Berkeley's greenhouse gas emissions. And gasoline transportation is the single largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in our community. So what's gasoline transportation? Gasoline transportation is...
No,
yes.
The natural gas, you just divide them. When you put them together, that's the single largest...
If you add up natural gas in two sectors, that will be larger than 29.
Yeah, natural gas in Berkeley.
It's, well, the math is fine. I mean,
it's not
if you add up natural gas, it's fine. Well,
yeah.
We can talk
so
about that later.
So that makes sense.
But transportation for gasoline, that is basically driving within our community. That's driving to events like this. It's driving to the store, driving to school, and so on. So that's vehicle miles traveled within the city limits within our community. Diesel transportation is mostly large vehicles driving within the Berkeley city limits. Now, the limitation of this is that it doesn't capture driving emissions outside of Berkeley. So, for example, it doesn't capture my vehicle trips outside of our city limits. And it doesn't capture people driving to Berkeley until they hit our city limits. And so it doesn't capture our whole scope of vehicle emissions that, you know, Berkeley is responsible for. So you have to look at other tools for capturing those types of emissions. The other interesting thing about the inventory that jumps out is how much more emissions come from natural gas in Berkeley than electricity. And that's mainly because we use more natural gas here for heating our water and heating our homes. Electricity would be higher if we used air conditioning, for example. The electricity emissions would also be higher if we had a dirtier mix of energy that went into producing our electricity. So if we lived in West Virginia, for example, that electricity piece of the pie would be bigger because there's a lot of coal consumed there to produce their electricity. So I've included a couple other things just because I thought you would be interested. This is a similar pie chart, but for the entire state of California. And you can see in California, again, transportation, very significant source of greenhouse gas emissions statewide. And that's not because we simply love our cars in California. That's not the only reason, and maybe that's probably a very small part of the reason. Again, the reason why that's so much bigger than some of the other sources is, again, because our electricity is relatively clean. And then we'll look again at the Bay Area. So this is just our region, and you see transportation in the Bay Area is about half of the pie. So I really just put that up just because I thought that you would find it interesting, basically, and to show that transportation is such a major part of the problem in our city, in our region, and in our state. Yes, sir?
Why is industrial included on the statewide Bay Area out of Berkeley?
That's really just a technical issue. So in Berkeley, we get our data that shows where our emissions come from PG&E. And PG&E will provide cities data that break down electricity consumption by commercial and by residential, and industrial is not a part of the pie. In Berkeley, industrial is included in those commercial emissions. So what was labeled as commercial in that Berkeley pie is actually commercial/industrial. Okay, so what I want to do now is I want to talk specifics about the plan. So we know where our emissions come from. What are some strategies we can implement here locally to address those emissions? And since transportation is such a major part of the problem in our city, in our region, and in our state, let's start with that. It helps to think of the transportation challenge, that is reducing greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector, as a three-legged stool. A three-legged stool needs all three legs to stand. If one leg does not exist, the stool falls over. Okay, so this is sort of a policy analogy. Okay, one of the legs of the stool for the transportation challenge is miles per gallon, really the fuel efficiency of our vehicles. So who controls how fuel efficient our vehicles are? Is it the city of Berkeley?
No.
Who is it?
Federal government.
Federal government, the CAFE standards.
CAFE standards.
And also the state government, right? The state government passed what's called the Pavley Bill in 2002. Federal government challenged the Pavley Bill, so it's currently in legal limbo. But when Pavley is implemented, the average automobile will be about 20% more efficient in 2020 than it is today. So the state and the federal government have a very large role when it comes to fuel efficiency. Not so much of a role here for local government, although there are things that we can do as a community to promote more fuel-efficient vehicles, certainly. But the larger role is at different levels of government. This middle leg is the carbon content of the fuels. So how much carbon is released when you consume a given fuel, like gasoline or diesel. Again, the state government has a much bigger role to play here. And in fact, Bruce mentioned AB 32. As part of the recent plan that came out, it's basically the state's climate action plan. There's a low carbon fuel standard that was originally designed. You know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, our governor, put that out as an executive order. So again, that's sort of a state level action. How much we drive in our community is the third leg of the stool. And there's one where the local governments and our community, our residents, our businesses have a much bigger role to play. We can affect how people drive, how much people drive, in a lot of different ways. And the Climate Action Plan tries to lay out some of the ways that we can enable people to drive less. Okay, I forgot I had this slide. But basically, the way that I think about it is that there's a bunch of different puzzle pieces. And we have to figure out what each one of these puzzle pieces are and assemble that puzzle in order to solve this transportation challenge. So the question is, what are the puzzle pieces, okay? One of them, obviously, when we're talking about transportation, is our mainstream public transit, right? AC Transit buses here and Bay Area Rapid Transit. These are two transit agencies that serve Berkeley well. About 20% of Berkeley residents commute to work using either BART or bus, and that's 2000 data, so it might even be more than that now. But clearly, they serve us well, but clearly there's room for improvement there. And I'll talk a little bit about ways in which we can improve public transit in our community. Another mode, another piece of the puzzle, is sort of underutilized alternative forms of transportation. And car share is one of them, where basically a number of individuals in a community can reserve a car on a given day at a given time and use that car when it's reserved, bring the car back, and then somebody else uses the car. This is a greenhouse gas emission reduction strategy because these car share vehicles are often much more fuel efficient than the average vehicle, and also because people that are members of car share tend to drive less and also tend to get rid of personal automobiles. Bicycling, obviously another important puzzle piece. A lot of people cycle in Berkeley, but also a lot of people don't feel safe enough to cycle in Berkeley. That's one of the things we've heard a lot through the climate action planning process. Mothers and fathers would say, I would ride more, but I don't feel safe riding with my kids, and so I don't. And so that's an issue that we have to address as part of our climate protection efforts. So cycling and also walking, pedestrianism, is another important alternative form of transportation, a piece of the puzzle. And finally, another piece of the puzzle is where we put our housing and where we put our jobs. People that live and work closer to transit drive less. It's as clear as that. And so we have to keep that in mind as millions more people are moving to the Bay Area every decade. All right, so a little bit more in depth. Specifically, what's in the climate action plan to address those pieces of the puzzle? Let's talk about buses first. A couple of the recommendations in the climate action plan is one, it's clear that we need more frequent service, more reliable service in certain parts of the community. That's come up a lot through this climate action planning process. It's important to remember that AC Transit is sort of a chronically underfunded agency, so it's not necessarily their fault. But they are, the more frequent service is something that's come up a lot, and clearly as part of our climate protection efforts here locally, we have to identify where more frequent service would get the most bang for the buck. Where do we need more frequent service? And where can we find the funding to do so? Funding is always an issue. And I should say also that this is, as much as a climate protection issue, this is an equity issue. You know, people that cannot afford to own a car, for example, should not have to own a car. And one of the ways that you can help people gain access to transportation and mobility is through land use measures and also through improved public transit. Real-time signage at bus stops, so when I go to a bus stop, I don't have to wonder whether the bus is coming or when the bus is coming. I know when I get there when it's going to arrive, and I can count on it being there and move on. That improves the frequency with which people will actually use public transit. BART. Many people commute to Berkeley by BART and from Berkeley by BART. Some people won't commute simply because their job is maybe a mile or a mile and a half from the BART station. So they can take the BART from East Alameda County, but then there's still that mile, mile and a half gap to where they work, and that's just too long to walk or ride a bike for some folks, and so they'll drive the whole way instead. And so one of the things that BART is looking at in partnership with the City of Berkeley is a network of shuttles that might get people from BART stations to their destinations, and that would do a lot to get people out of cars. Bus rapid transit is something that's being debated in the community right now. That debate will be ongoing. It certainly has potential to address increased demand, transportation demand that we can pretty much count on in our city and in our region. We have about 2 million more people moving to the Bay Area in the next 20 years, about 1 million more cars, if I'm not mistaken. If we don't do something to address future demand, then we're looking at gridlock, and we're certainly not going to achieve our greenhouse gas emission reduction goals. One of the other things that gets people to drive less or use transit more is how much transit costs. And so the Climate Action Plan recommends looking at ways in which we can provide free transit passes, free bus passes and BART passes to people that work and live in Berkeley. A number of council members actually are very passionate about this issue. I'm just going to get through transportation, then I'll take your questions. So let's look at, that was mainly mainstream public transit. Let's talk a little bit about what the plan recommends for other forms of transportation. So this is the LBNL shuttle bus here, which transports people from, you know, downtown Berkeley up the hill to LBNL. This is not necessarily a very clean shuttle, but it does get people out of cars. And LBNL, UC Berkeley, and a number of other agencies within the city are very interested in a more integrated shuttle network that can get people from West Berkeley to downtown Berkeley, throughout downtown, throughout West Berkeley, north, south, and so on. That would be a wonderful addition to our public transportation options here in our community, and it would help fill the gaps between AC Transit and BART. So the Climate Action Plan recommends an integrated shuttle network in our community. Again, we have to find out how to prioritize that and how to fund it, but it's certainly a strategy that's consistent with our climate protection goals. I mentioned car share already. There was a study in San Francisco that showed that 30% of car share members got rid of one of their private vehicles. And again, these vehicles are generally much more fuel efficient than the average vehicle. So the plan recommends more car share pods throughout the community, potentially car share, being able to site car share vehicles in private driveways, and the neighborhood being able to share one vehicle. This is a strategy that could help up in the hills, where public transit is less available. I've heard a lot from hills residents throughout this process that say they have a hard time getting around without driving. Pedestrianism, walking here, and cycling. Again, safety is a big issue. It's come up again and again and again. And so the city's bicycle plan and pedestrian plan go a long way to addressing that. We have to find ways to implement those plans more quickly in order to improve safety in our community, which would hopefully will enable people to walk more, bike more, and drive less. That other piece of the puzzle that I mentioned was land use and how we design our community in a way that enables people not to have to drive, okay? This chart basically shows the relationship between how much people drive and where they live. And so all the way to the left here, you see a typical suburb where you have about 5 dwelling units per acre. And in a suburb like that, a typical household will drive about 21,000 miles per household per year. And if you compare that to an urban center, like a dense part of San Francisco, you can see a typical household will drive about 4,000 miles per household per year. So it's a significant difference between how much people drive when they live in an urban center, close to transit, close to where they work, close to where they shop, and far out where they have to drive everywhere. It makes a lot of sense. It's sort of common sense. The closer you live to transit, the less you have to drive. And people will choose to drive less if it's convenient to do so, if it's accessible to do so, and if it's safe to do so. So this is just something we have to keep in mind as we have more and more people moving to our community. Where are they going to live? It's not if we're going to grow in Berkeley, it's how are we going to grow. Are we going to grow in a way that enables us to achieve our climate protection goals, our social equity goals as well, putting more people closer to where they can get around without having to drive? So a couple of the specific recommendations in the plan regarding land use is, makes sense, more housing and more jobs near our BART stations, so people have easy access to those BART stations. Planning commissioners, zoning adjustment board members need to have better tools to sort of analyze projects that come their way. They need to be able to better understand whether a given project, a given development will increase vehicle miles traveled, will it not increase vehicle miles traveled, is it consistent with our climate protection goals? And certainly our adaptive reuse of buildings when appropriate is certainly has to be part of our climate protection goals as well. The thing I like to just note is that these issues are never black and white. There's a lot of gray area between what's right and what's wrong sometimes. It's not always right to keep a building where it is, and it's not always right. Density is not always right. It's how you build it, if you build it. There's a lot of questions that are in between. And so it's not black and white. There's not always a clear right and wrong. And so that's why we have community processes to think a lot of these things over. So I wanted to move on to talking about building energy use. Did you have a comment about transportation land use? Go ahead.
Yes. I used to bike in this area a lot. Excellent park for people biking. It's flat, very well suited, and extremely dangerous. This is also the area that has the highest density of driving. People moving through this area get up the hill, get to campus, and travel. So it's very well suited to a solution in which certain streets are closed off entirely to any vehicles except bicycles. Mm-hmm. And for that, electric vehicle would be an appropriate solution because not everyone can buy it. And electric vehicles subsidized by, presumably, Vets and the city that were kept in this area only. This area is extremely well suited for electric vehicles, mm-hmm. for exactly the same reason it's good for bicycles. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of hills, there's not a lot of battery capacity issues, and you can run small electric vehicles in this area very efficiently. We deliver electric vehicle-based response to shoppers and locate parking down in the Marina area for to develop that area. So I think this is a set of ideas that might well fit into the plan we're proposing to build mm-hmm. here. Mm-hmm. And I'm suggesting that maybe consider.
I appreciate that. I think that electric vehicles are, you know, it seems obvious that electric vehicles are the wave of the future at this point. You know, the technology is getting better and better and better. One of the challenges is the infrastructure. And there's a lot of groups that are working very, very hard on that. But the Climate Action Plan, certainly is consistent with what the Climate Action Plan says.
My suggestion is not for the future, but the long future.
Yeah, short term. Short term.
And concentrating on the flats, vehicles are already ready. Mm-hmm. You can buy them, put them in place, not have to wait, you do not need it. The next greatest looking battery. Yeah. We can do it, we can do it right away.
Okay, yes.
So you talked about how the plan and moral cooperation with the university in the city.
Yeah.
There was a huge swarm of people coming into the university every day from outside the city. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, the university is our largest employer, right? So you're right. A huge swarm of people that drive to and from other parts of the county or the region to the university every day. And one of the specific strategies in the plan to address that is to work with the university to identify local housing options. So match housing with jobs, right? Match housing with jobs so people can live closer to where they work and not have to drive as far to reach their employment destination. So that's one of the specific strategies in the plan to address that. In the back, and then you, Mara.
Okay. My name is Cecilia, and I have a question about the USA Today article that came out about the air quality in Southwest Berkeley.
Yeah.
And I know that the plan sort of has long-term goals for dealing with air quality issues with all the components you've laid out, but it seems to me that we have an immediate crisis in quality of air near schools. My child is in one of those schools that's impacted. And so how does the plan, or how are we, City Council and others, dealing with the immediate needs to address air quality in Southwest Berkeley?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question. I don't know that right now I have a great answer. I don't know that I'm the right one to provide that answer. The Climate Action Plan is focused pretty specifically on greenhouse gas emissions, which ultimately will generally have the co-benefit of reducing local air pollution. So the transportation strategies in here specifically will significantly reduce local air pollutants. Now, the USA Today article, I understand, is sort of doesn't look as much at transportation, but single sources of local air pollutants. So I'm not the best person to answer that question. I don't know if anybody else that works for the city wants to, but I could certainly follow up with you. Oh, go ahead, Ryan. Yeah.
I have an idea on it. I go through there all the time downtown, and it's near Berkeley High School. And the air is filthy, and I haven't made myself wear the mask that I should because it's affecting my breathing, riding my bike. Mm-hmm. The streets are filthy. They're never cleaned by the city. Mm-hmm. And the construction, let's say the Shattuck Hotel and the Y and all of those buildings around there, I had to call OSHA. And they cleaned them up for a day or two, but that's about it. And I feel really sorry, you talk about equity, the Hispanic workers, they have no idea, and they're in that hotel, and the stuff is thick, you go by it. And so the high school kids have to breathe that. The other thing is, we're talking about transportation and all these buildings and stuff that they're building, and our elected officials aren't responsible enough to take care of it. I wrote to them, I sent it to the Planning Commission. The other part is the transportation itself. Because they have these big BRT buses, those double ones, we have small streets. They don't work in Berkeley. They work downtown Oakland, and from there forward, we shouldn't have buses that size. We should have shuttles and other things that work, and they should be clean air. But what they do is when they try to park them downtown, there's no room for the local buses. So now they're running all around by Berkeley High, and where it used to be quiet and peaceful, you have these buses. I just saw another one today. They keep moving them in. And so it's disaster. And the transportation and land use, it's disaster.
You can
so
wrap
you're
up
talking about it. Yeah. I'm finishing. But yeah. I'm letting you know that you're not doing it. You're
Thank
doing
you.
The opposite.
Thank you.
Yeah. You mentioned that if you had denser neighborhoods, it decreases driving miles. If people live closer to their jobs. But besides the University of California, where are you creating jobs in Berkeley?
Well, there's a lot of areas of Berkeley that are prime for increased employment. And I should say, as directly as relates to the Climate Action Plan, a lot of the strategies that I'm about to talk about with building energy use call for a significant amount of more energy services in the residential and the commercial sector. So more people doing energy audits, more people installing solar panels, more people doing energy efficiency retrofits. Those are sort of what are termed green collar jobs. And when this plan is implemented, you'll see a huge increase in the types in demand for those types of jobs. So that's part of the answer to your question.
And
the
other makes sense to create the jobs and then the demand for housing. I mean, if you do it the other way around, you're just feeding the status quo.
I'm sorry. What was that?
If you create the jobs first, then there's a demand for housing. Mm-hmm. But if you create if you make it dense first, there's nothing to make people stay here and work.
There's already 20,000 more jobs in Berkeley than there is homes. So there's already a significant more jobs than there is housing. Yes, sir.
Hi, I speak as a bicyclist. We have this perception that it's dangerous to ride a bicycle in Berkeley. But if you look at the number of accidents per head in Berkeley, it's higher than surrounding cities. But for the number of bicycle miles traveled, it's relatively low. In fact, we need to get the message out that bicycle is actually a pretty safe place to ride a bicycle. Mm-hmm. The chances of there being a bicycle accident on any given day in Berkeley are greater than other cities.
Right.
The chances that you or I personally get a bicycle accident are lower in Berkeley. A lot of the car drivers have got the message that they need to treat bicycles as equal users.
Yeah.
But we need to get the word out that bicycling is a relatively safe proposition in Berkeley.
I think that's a really good point, although people's perceptions are important. And so taking steps to address those perceptions, real steps to make bicycling safer, has a lot of benefits to it. But you're right. It is a good point. But the perception is out there and it has to be addressed.
Yeah, it depends on where you're biking.
Yeah. Yes.
One thing that would be positive is that there needs to be more money allocated for economic development in Berkeley. And except for the green corridor, I don't think there's any money this year in the budget for saving for economic development. And we need this because the idea for building on transit corridors is that there'll be businesses there. And I'm sorry to say this, I have to go to the mall, either in Hilltop, Richmond, or Sunnyvale, to buy underwear. Because that's just one example of many. We don't have one department store. We had a Hanks downtown, and then the rents tripled for Ross, and they moved out, and the plan was to make it the arts district. I would love to be able to walk to buy certain things, and I can't now. So I think we do need to get, you know, jobs for people, but also jobs, you know, businesses that are, we need more pro-business attitude, and we need to figure out our empty storefronts first before we have a fanciful idea that we're going to build the houses, and then there's going to be businesses nearby because Berkeley has failed so far.
That's a fantastic point. There has to be a mix of uses, so it's, you know,
people. I have a department store somewhere.
That's a really, really good point. That's a really good point. And
that's
yes, it is. It is. That is addressed directly in the plan.
It says that you will build the buildings and there will be less driving because there'll be businesses near it. But there's not.
No, it says add retail. I can show you.
But you can say add retail, but the economic policies to date have failed. And so
yes.
If you build the houses, there'll be more empty storefronts unless you get the part first, which is healthy businesses.
Yeah, I think I'm agreeing with you. I think that maybe it's probably not one directly in front of the other, but there's probably some combination of those things that you have to work on at the same time. Yes, ma'am.
I've read about two-thirds of the plan thoroughly. And I have many, many questions and comments, which I will give to you in writing.
Thank you.
But the one I want to ask you tonight, because I'm sure everybody who reads the plan is going to ask you this. In the beginning, you make the statement that although the number of households and population has pretty much remained the same, since 1960 there have been 20,000 more cars added to the vehicle population. But you don't say where or why or how. You don't explain that. I'm very curious what the analysis is. It seems to me it'd be relatively easy to get the DMV registration data and map it so we could see where those extra cars are. But what's your explanation for that?
You know, the study that was conducted to come up with those numbers, I think it was conducted in about 2000. And I think it was done using the census track, but I'd have to look back at the study, and I could certainly do that for you.
It's also tough. I mean, I've asked a lot of people. Everyone has a different theory.
Uh-huh.
Some people say, oh, well, the students now have cars, where they used to not have cars. My supposition is that if you look at the census data, you will see that median income in Berkeley has risen. And so my supposition is that the second car is connected to higher income and is essentially a luxury item. So that's why when I saw Nancy Skinner the other night, I said, Nancy, tax the second car as a luxury item. Because, you know, all of this behavior modification is nice and everything, but if you want to kill a car, you have to tax it to death.
That'll never work.
Berkeley
is not alone in this. This is the trend across the country. It's wealth. I mean, you look at what's happening in the economy now. We've had at least 30 years of building an economy on cheap credit, cheap money. And part of that has been car loans and making cars much more affordable so that households have, you know, in some cities now, more cars per person. They have more cars than people within a household. So, you know, wealth has really been a big part of this.
Just push the cars.
Yes.
This is an example of where we have to think innovatively about transportation, because if you just tax a second car, if a second car is an electrical one, you shot yourself in the foot again. So we have to think about what encourages drops in greenhouse gas emissions. The other point I wanted to raise about transportation and land use is that if we look at developers who are siting buildings and projects,
yeah.
We looked at transportation as a necessary component of a building site. We start holding developers responsible for creative transportation solutions for that site, so that a building comes with a supply of electric automobiles as part of its permitting.
Yes.
It's not just there preying upon the transportation services in the region just because it got built.
Yeah,
but
right.
It actually contributes something to the transportation solutions in the region.
Yes. They have to provide car share pod, bicycle parking, bicycle showers for employees, that type of thing.
And I was wondering if the manufacturing zoning issues are getting sorted out so that they can, I know this is not that kind of meeting, but if you want to encourage jobs, holding on to light industrial manufacturing zone areas of the city, especially in West Berkeley, where we can have mixed use permitting and modern standards for manufacture that are more office intensive than the old factory used to be. We can start to favor more likely siting of light industry, especially in the recycling and product industry, boutique crafts, assembly, and that sort of thing.
Councilor Anderson, if you want to.
Just on this point, it used to be that if a municipality didn't want to do something, they say that it's a regional problem. And we need a regional solution to it. But more and more, as we get beset by the greenhouse gases and CO2 emissions, it really is a regional problem. I mean, if Berkeley were to institute unilaterally some of the things that are suggested here, it may not have the desired effect that we want it to have.
Yes.
And that's why it's important to really step up the efforts on regionalism around here, especially where it pertains to these issues that we know are not local issues.
Yeah.
You know, how we do that is problematic, but it has to be done. I think the mayor of Berkeley and several other communities around here create this green corridor is a step in that direction. But you look at the amount of resources that the Metropolitan Transportation Commission controls, the influence that ABAG has. These are the seats of regional power that I think we need to start to engage in a more forceful way to force some of these solutions that we all have to share. So that's my
point. Fantastic point. And as Dan Marks always says, there's 110 different cities in the Bay Area, and each one of those cities has its own land use policies.
Right.
There's not coordination across cities. Now, one thing that is may address that in the future is recent state legislation, SB 375, which is part of, again, the scoping plan that the state just released, the statewide climate action plan, which would basically establish regional greenhouse gas emissions reduction targets. So the Bay Area would have an emissions reduction target for the region, and the cities would have to work with regional agencies to develop plans for achieving those targets. And so the sort of directly influences land use decisions, and it sort of makes them regional in a way that they're not right now. All right, thanks for all those comments. Marna, by the way, is a colleague in the Office of Energy and Sustainable Development, and she's making sure she gets everything down that people say. Okay, so let's talk a little bit. So we looked at transportation side of things. Let's talk about energy use in buildings, another significant portion of Berkeley's greenhouse gas emissions, natural gas consumption in our homes and our businesses and our industries, and electricity consumption. This is what I'm talking about. The goal of the plan, or sort of the vision for the plan, is to enhance minimum standards, things that you have to do at minimum, and also to provide more services to the community, so it's easier to use less energy, basically. And so a good example of what I'm talking about with minimum standards is our residential energy conservation ordinance and its sister ordinance, the commercial energy conservation ordinance, which have been existing in Berkeley since the early 80s. And what these ordinances do is basically when a home or a business turns over, changes hands at the point of sale, or when a major renovation is done, there's a certain suite of basic energy saving and water saving measures that have to be implemented by either the seller or the buyer. Okay, it's a prescriptive list. The Climate Action Plan recommends going away from the prescriptive and more towards the performance-based, so that when a home turns over, somebody comes into that home and does a pretty comprehensive energy audit, an energy analysis, and finds out where the energy leaks are and lays out a roadmap for how energy can be saved in that building. Then it'd be the responsibility of the property owner to implement some of those measures in order to achieve a certain performance. So each measure would have a score. And then every time when that home turns over, there would be additional responsibility to make that home more energy efficient. So it's moving from prescriptive to performance-based. That's an example of how the plan recommends enhancing the minimum standards in Berkeley. But beyond just sort of making people do things, it's important to provide services that people can do on their own. And so a good example of that is the energy efficiency and job training program that the Rising Sun Energy Center is right now developing and looking for funding for. Many of you have probably had California Youth Energy Services. The youth come into your home. They do a free energy saving. They provide free light bulbs, free water saving devices. They do a basic energy audit. Rising Sun Energy Center is looking at expanding that program to provide more training to more individuals so that those individuals can come into a home and do a more comprehensive energy audit, more comprehensive energy analysis, and provide more cost-saving and energy-saving assistance. Again, something like that has a couple of different benefits. One is it helps us reduce energy consumption. When you reduce energy consumption, you save money. But also creates a lot of jobs. If the Berkeley Climate Action Plan is implemented and the other cities in our region that are working on similar strategies implement their plans, there will be a huge increase in demand for the types of jobs that enable people to get into homes and businesses and do energy audits, put solar panels on roofs, and so on. So it's an environmental issue, but it's also very much an economic and a social issue as well. The plan recommends looking into an energy efficiency revolving loan fund for low-income households. This would be a revolving loan fund that would be paid back at the time the home is sold. It would be a no-interest loan. We're sort of at the beginning of stages of looking at this idea, but the plan and sort of our community recognizes that our climate protection strategies have to be consistent with social policy that looks after the underserved. Streamlining opportunities for landlords and tenants to save energy. Right now, huge issue across the country. Landlords have no incentive to save energy in their multifamily buildings because they often don't pay the energy bills. So there's no incentive for the landlord to invest in energy efficiency. Meanwhile, tenants aren't going to invest a whole lot of money if they're renting and they don't sort of own the building. So it's what people refer to as the split incentive. Now, there are opportunities for landlords to pass the cost through of energy-saving measures to their tenants. But that opportunity is very complicated and it's not taken advantage of very much by landlords. The idea is that if the landlord can show that he or she is saving energy in a given unit, then he can pass the cost through to the tenant of the amount of money that it took to save that energy, to implement the measure that saved that energy. So the tenant's energy bill would go down, the rent would go up, so the net payment would be the same. Low-cost audits and energy retrofits for small businesses. We are in Berkeley, we are largely small businesses. The large majority of businesses in Berkeley have 10 employees or less. There's an organization in Berkeley, California Energy Services Corporation, that runs a program called Smart Lights. We want to enhance that program to provide more subsidized energy audits to businesses and more comprehensive energy retrofits to small businesses as well. Again, it's a great business idea because it saves money, but it's also good for the planet. Many of you have probably heard about our solar financing initiative. We launched what we call Berkeley First, the financing initiative for renewable and solar technology in November 3rd. We launched a 40-household pilot project. And the concept behind this program is that it costs a lot of money up front for a private property owner to put solar panels on their roof. It costs so much money, in fact, that the large majority of people won't do it. And so as we were developing climate protection strategies, we thought about how do we get over that barrier? How do we address that barrier? And the solution that we came up with was to provide upfront financing to a private property owner to pay for the cost of solar. That private property owner pays that money back to the city as a 20-year assessment on their property tax bill at a competitive interest rate. When the property turns over, the new property owner comes in and picks up the payments. So we think it's been launched as a pilot project right now. We opened it to 40 households on November 3rd. Within 10 minutes, upwards of 40 households had applied. And so the project is up and running now. We're going through the process of checking paperwork, making sure that people are the owners of the house that they say they are, and we'll be pushing financing out the door soon. Yeah?
Did you see the letter to the planet today where they talk about changes to the federal tax code? Pretty much don't favor this approach, they favor different.
I didn't see the letter in the planet, no.
Could you explain it a little bit more?
I don't know all the details of the letter, but it has been changing federal taxes.
Yeah. I don't want to get too much into detail right now, but there is some question as to whether the federal tax incentive for solar is available to people that participate in the program. The idea is to expand this program. Right now in the pilot phase, it's available for solar electric, but the idea is to expand it to solar thermal for solar hot water and for energy efficiency measures in your home as well. And if you want to learn more about this program, this is the website to check out, cityofberkeley.info/sustainable. Any question about the building energy use side of things? I'm going to talk a little bit more about our waste-related strategies now, and then I want to wrap up so we have plenty of time for questions.
You didn't address government buildings like this one?
Yes. The Climate Action Plan does address government buildings in a number of different ways. One, new construction, new city government construction. Already there's a policy on the books that has to achieve LEED Silver. So that's new construction. But existing construction, actually, our office, the energy office, is responsible for comprehensive energy audits and retrofits in all city buildings. And so we have an ongoing program monitoring energy consumption in all buildings, lighting retrofits in virtually every building. I don't know if this building's been hit yet, but most of the buildings have. And so there is an ongoing program to increase energy efficiency in city-owned buildings. Yes?
Yeah, getting higher density housing around our main transportation artery, which is parking. I think that's the obvious argument.
Yep.
Build more housing around. Means essentially building high rise of some sort of high density housing around North Berkeley Park and around the Ashley Park. Obviously, we're not going to do it right around some extent, right around downtown Park.
This is
going to really change the character of those. Is there something either in this plan or is there an associated planning commission plan about that impact of that housing? Obviously has a lot of value. There's going to be a lot of people who want to make a lot of money on that high density housing. Mm-hmm. So there'll be a lot of incentive to get it done.
Believe it or not,
around there, will there be parks around these things?
Believe it or not, you're not the first person to bring up that question. the plan is fairly high-level policy document. It outlines the relationship between how much people drive and where they live. And it makes recommendations based on the fact that if people live closer to transit, they drive less. Now, what that looks like, what that density looks like, how we accommodate more housing and more jobs near our BART stations is something that we're going to have to figure out as a community, okay? Our community is not going to let Berkeley turn into Manhattan.
Oh, yeah.
And I would hope that our community would also not put any new one-story development right near a BART station as well. Those are the two extremes. So we have to find somewhere in between that's consistent with our desire to maintain the character of our community, but also consistent with our policy priorities to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and improve public health and enable people to get around without having to drive. And we have to figure that out as a community. So real quickly, because I want to move on.
Yeah, let me finish that question with one option.
Very quickly.
We do have a lot more jobs in Berkeley than houses. Most of those jobs are on campus. Why are we thinking about high-density housing near campus? Because then the foot becomes a transportation option.
Yeah, I think the downtown area plan, which is ongoing right now, is really grappling with that issue right now. And the downtown is directly adjacent to campus. So I think we are thinking about that. So let's talk about waste reduction and recycling, another big piece of the puzzle. The vision is to sort of eliminate waste as much as possible, but the waste that we do produce, let's recycle it, compost it, or reuse it. So very quickly, so I can save time for more questions, one of the main areas in Berkeley that isn't able to recycle and compost as much because there's not as many services is multi-family buildings. You know, the residents in single-family homes have great service and recycle a lot. And as a community, we recycle, we divert about 50% of our waste from the landfill. We have a goal of zero waste by the year 2020. We have a long way to go. One of the niches that we have to fill is multi-family buildings. And one of the ways that we can do that is simply provide more service to those buildings. Work with building managers, building owners to provide recycling systems within the buildings. Integrate language into leases that outline the responsibility for building managers and building owners to provide recycling services and encourage tenants to recycle and compost more. I talked about California Youth Energy Services, which does basic energy audits in homes. What about integrating a waste audit into that program as well, so that when a student comes into my home, he or she looks at my energy use, but also what am I doing with my waste, and how can I improve waste diversion in my household? That's another strategy recommended in the plan. I think this is my last slide, and that's really just to emphasize. Oh, yes, sir.
What about design requirements for a new building so that internally we engineer a more easily facilitated recycling operation within the building because it's been designed to accommodate that?
Yes.
Rather than try to fit the services in this large, sort of massive, out of shape, but sort of not residential, single family problem that we have to
do. Yeah, and you know, we basically we need both, because the large majority of our buildings are going to be the ones that are here now. And so we have to figure out how to get in those buildings. But the low-hanging fruit is to make sure that any new buildings provides space for the types of containers that enable people to recycle more. Yes?
How
nice
to
Okay. The plan represents going beyond what we're doing now. And if it didn't, it wouldn't be a very good plan. It talks about making deeper cuts than what we're making right now to our greenhouse gas emissions. And in order to do that, it's going to take some investment. It's going to take public investment and private investment. The large amount of the investment is going to be people making different choices, people going solar, people investing in energy efficiency in their homes and their businesses. But the city can help that out. And one of the ways that we can help that out is through Berkeley First, for example, through our financing initiative. But the plan also recommends sort of briefly some potential sources of revenue, all that need further vetting, and all that can be very painful to implement. So we know that we need additional revenue to implement the plan. Where is that revenue going to come from? That's an open question that we have to figure out moving forward. It's an important question. Parking is one of the potential areas. Raising the cost of parking would be an example. Wouldn't be a popular move. Transportation services fee. Any new development would have to pay a certain fee to offset the demand that they create for transportation services within the community. Open space fee would be similar. New development would pay a small fee that would be committed to enhancing existing green or open space within the community, or where possible, creating more open space and green space in the community. A carbon tax. The city of Boulder, Colorado, is the only city in the country right now that has a carbon tax. It's a small tax on electricity and natural gas consumption in all buildings, residential, commercial, and industrial. I think homes pay about an extra $5 a year or something like that, and businesses pay an extra $12 or $15 a year. They use that revenue to implement strategies like the ones that I've been talking about. Is that something that we should do here?
Yeah.
I'm not saying yes or no, but it's something that we should think about. And of course, grants are something that city staff are always doing anyway, looking after funding to try and do all the cool things that we want to do as a community. So I think I will end there and take more of your questions. I just wanted to say that this is where the plan is right now, berkeleyclimateaction.org. The draft plan is posted there. You can review it there, and you can actually comment directly on this website. The goal is to present a revised climate action plan to council later in the spring. It'll be March or something like that. The date is not determined, but when it is, we'll certainly let you know.
Can you all speak to this?
Oh, yeah. Thanks for reminding me. This form that was on your chair, this is just another way for you to provide feedback. It asks a couple specific questions. I definitely encourage you to fill it out, and we will use this, take this back again, and take comments from here, and it'll help us make a better plan. Yeah?
When I comment on this, my comments will be voluminous. So I looked at the site, and it looked like you just had room for little comments. What happens if you want to write a lot of comments?
You can do a couple of different things. One is you could just send them directly to me by email.
Oh, okay. What's your email?
And second is you could, there is a place on the site to post larger comments, but there's my email there. You're welcome to email me directly. Yes.
Well, this is a plan.
Yes.
And so you're planning for the future. But when we have good things now, uh-huh. Are you planning to save them? And I'll give you an example.
Yes.
Okay. On Cedar and San Pablo, there's a totally green car place. They're all electric.
Oh,
you plug them in, you can plug them into solar. And Mayor Bates was bragging about how he had this, when he was running for his election. However, they only had a year lease. It was right up after the election. And now a developer wants to knock the whole place down, build, even though there are empty apartments on San Pablo. So I say, hey,
let's
wait a minute. Here we have this, and you've got your solar plan. So what can you do to keep that? Because we need that type of car. And the developers say, we need to have all the cars down by the freeway. But the freeway is, hold your nose, that isn't a place where people will see them and buy them.
So you're right. That is the type of place that we want in Berkeley. And I know that people are working very hard to keep it in
How
in
can
the
they
community.
Keep it if they're letting it go?
I can't address that directly, but I know that they're working really hard.
Address it would be a good thing to start. Okay, let's do it.
I agree. Other questions? Did you have one? I thought I saw your hand up.
So what I was wondering, I appreciate that the public notice period is extended to January 16th.
Yeah.
So I want to know what the timeline is. So we get now to ask the question. So we write our comments in by the 16th.
Yeah, before would be great, but yes, you have till the 16th.
Till the 16th.
Yeah.
And then does this get incorporated somehow into responses in a document?
It gets incorporated directly into the climate action plan. It's not an EIR where every separate comment is addressed specifically in an appendix. But basically what we've been doing, and I think as it's reflected in the climate action plan, public comment is integrated into the climate
action. So you'll say some people think this, some people think that, or some people ask this, so it will...
It's a balancing act. I mean, luckily, mostly... In general, most comments are fairly consistent with the desire to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So nobody has said we need more cars in Berkeley to address the greenhouse gas emissions issue. So most of the comments are not so much conflicting as they are. Some are just so hard to do and so far out there that they're hard to integrate in. But you should submit your comments and we do our best job as possible to integrate those.
Yeah, will it take like a month or 2 months before those?
And then the timeline, we're still figuring that out. So hopefully we'll get back to council as early in the spring as possible, by March or so, but we're just going to have to keep the community posted on when we can get back to council. Real quick, I'll take these two questions, then I wanted to bring up a representative from the Ecology Center really quickly.
Yeah. I just had two quick questions. The first one is, if there are statistics in the draft that don't have citations, how do we get those from you?
You can just contact me directly, yeah.
And then two, when they were drafting this plan, I mean, there's other plans. There's health plans, and they have direct conflict. Is anybody going to, the city going to look at the how they implement.
Yeah, if you have specific examples of that, you should certainly let me know. And I'm sure there are places where we haven't caught some of those things. We've done our best job to do that. But specific examples, please. That's exactly what we want to hear. Yes.
Are you the author of the plan?
No, I am sort of the coordinator of the plan. We have a cross-departmental team that contributed to the Climate Action Plan, and a lot of the comments are specifically from the community. So I did end up writing a lot of the narrative, but you know, I wouldn't feel right saying I was the author.
Who wrote the chapter on land use?
It was a collaborative effort.
Who were the people that were collaborating?
I mean, I did a lot of the specific writing, but it had gone through a number of vetting.
He's the leader who wrote it, but the other people helped and was collaborative.
Yeah, exactly. It's a collaborative piece. There's not one author.
But who's writing it?
It's not a secret. It's a collaborative effort, and that's how the plan was produced.
Who are they? Who are they?
Next question.
Uh-oh, you're not answering.
Merrily, I've answered the question.
I
wanted to introduce Beck Howes from the Ecology Center. You know, a lot of the a lot of the questions that I've gotten throughout this process, the Climate Action Planning process, is okay. This is a plan. It's a great plan. Needs work here and there. But what can I do right now? What are actions I can take in my home or my business right now? And so I wanted to invite Beck here to help us answer that question. So briefly, Beck, if you could talk about this.
Hi, I think I know about you. Coming to the Ecology Center. And we have an environmental resource center there where we do lots of classes and help you with our information desk services, lots of stuff. I wanted to mention a project that we have. It's Climate Change Action Groups. And basically, it's a way for a group of people to come together and sort of in a somewhat support group kind of fashion, help each other lower their carbon footprints. And we use this workbook, the Low Carbon Diet workbook, way to get together around these things. There's exercises in here on lowering your energy consumption or recycling or in many ways that you can lower your footprint. Carbon dioxide, we all know, is a big greenhouse gas, but there's other things like methane that come from garbage landfills. And so recycling and lowering your waste production is a good way to lower your footprint too. So anyway, I just generally would like to encourage you to join one of these groups or encourage people that you know to join these groups. They're ongoing. We're starting new groups in January. It can be like a new sort of New Year's resolution, work on this yourself. If you're here, you're probably already really engaged with the issues, so maybe it's a way you can encourage people that you know to do this too. So please contact us for this or any other environmental question you may have.
And save the date, right, to January 28th?
Oh, that too. Yeah, we also have this really great event we're doing on January 28th. The Ecology Center, along with the City of Berkeley and the Energy Commission, are having a wonderful event at the Hillside Club where people can come that day and bring people that they know and basically begin this kind of work too. So, January 28th, and if you want to find that event or other events like this, you can look on the Ecology Center Eco Calendar on our website. That's a good way to find events that can help you with these issues. So on this flyer here is contact information. So, okay, thanks a lot.
Could you answer one question? The methane. I can't understand why that is so much worse than carbon dioxide.
It's a chemistry thing.
I know. But it just has the same number of C's, so I don't understand.
Yeah, I don't know the chemistry of it, but I just know that methane is a much more powerful gas than CO2. So
I wanted to turn it back over to Councilmember Anderson, and I wanted to personally thank all of you for coming out tonight and all of your comments. You know where to reach me, you know our website. We'll be having other events after this one, so keep an eye out. But thanks again for coming.
Well, first of all, I want to thank the staff for being so forthcoming with the document and leading this discussion that allowed us to make some suggestions and input into what is undoubtedly one of the most important undertakings that the city can engage in, because we're fighting a huge global problem and we're acting locally and thinking globally. And this is the kind of community effort that when it reaches down to this level where individual citizens can come out and participate in a process that eventually will yield a plan for us all to embrace and push forward so that we can reach some of the goals and forestall some of the disasters that we see looming in front of us. So thanks to the staff. Also want to recognize Councilmember Worthington here has come out as well to participate. And most of all, I want to thank you as individuals and representatives of neighborhoods that come out and take this thing seriously, gather the information, give us your thoughts so that we can eventually assemble a complete and comprehensive and a plan that's reflective of people's understanding of the issues and their willingness also to, as individuals, take part in the implementation of this. Because this is, Councilmember Moore said in the onset, that this is the kind of effort that requires everybody's initiative and input, and this is where it starts. To create a series of drafts. This is actually the second draft of the Climate Action Plan. And by the time it gets to the council, it's our hope that it will reflect the good thinking and foresight and life experiences that you breathe into this plan so that it's more than just a cold document that may sit on the shelf somewhere, but it's part of your thinking, part of your understanding of what's necessary for all of us to do to make sure that we can breathe and that the polar caps don't melt and that we can have some measure of cooperation, as I said earlier, in a regional sense, because it's all of our problems. So thank you very, very much for coming out, and we look forward to the next public review process that we put in place so that we can take even more of your comments and your contributions to this. And please, take advantage of the website, take advantage of emailing your comments more detailed and more thought out, and we will try to make every effort to incorporate this into a plan that we can all be proud of and that we can all help implement. Thank you very much.